So you've just moved house then, and some friends are coming over to see you. And whereas once over, that would have necessitated a 5 or 10 minute phone call, giving your friend detailed directions, talking him through every roundabout, every T-junction, every set of traffic lights, nowadays you simply give him your postcode. And he can type that into his sat-nav, or he can type it into his computer and print off a map or a set of instructions. And it's all very easy, and it's all very convenient. It's a notable testimony to the benefits of modern technology. But of course, you do need to give him your postcode. No matter what gadgets he has at his disposal, it would be unreasonable to expect him to turn up on the appointed day at the appointed time if he has no information about your location. And in the early part of John chapter 14, Thomas feels that Jesus is demonstrating that kind of unreasonableness. In verse 2 of that passage, Jesus has told his disciples that he is going to his Father's house. Now that phrase, "my Father's house," may make perfect sense to you and to me. We understand immediately he's talking about heaven. But remember, these disciples at this stage lack many of the privileges which you and I enjoy. Chronologically speaking, they are on the wrong side of the cross and the resurrection and the day of Pentecost. They don't have a complete Bible. They are still essentially Old Testament believers, struggling to cope with this sudden, seismic leap forward in God's redemptive story. Every day that they spend with Jesus, they are encountering new concepts, and they don't have the mental categories to put those concepts into. They don't have the mental Velcro strips to stick those concepts onto. And my Father's house then just seems like another enigmatic, cryptic, elusive term to their untrained ears. And when, therefore, Jesus then goes on in verse 4 to say to them, "You know the way. You know the way to this place." Well, Thomas can contain himself no longer. He simply has to protest. "Lord," verse 5, "we don't know where you are going. So how can we know the way? You haven't given us the postcode. You haven't even given us a street name. You've only given us some vague language about a house belonging to your Father. Apart from that, we have no information about this location. How the dickens, then, can we possibly know the way?" And you and I should be glad this morning for Thomas's exasperated outburst. Because Thomas's exasperated outburst here prompted one of the great utterances of Scripture. The one which we find in verse 6, and concerning which then, I just want to draw your attention this morning to two things. I want us to notice in this verse a clarification and a claim. A clarification and a claim. First of all then, this morning, a clarification. When Hannah and I were getting to know each other all those years ago in Aberystwyth, I don't remember her ever telling me about the layout or room sizes or decor of her parents' house back in South Wales. I don't remember ever telling her about the layout or room sizes or decor of my parents' house back in North Yorkshire. But I'm sure that she did tell me about her parents, and I'm sure that I did tell her about my parents. And in talking about parents rather than parental houses then, we were betraying a certain scale of values, weren't we? Namely, that people are more important than places. Relationships are more important than residences. And that scale of values isn't confined, apparently, to the human level. It operates at the divine level too. Because here in this passage, we have Jesus, the Son of God, and he has mentioned his Father's house. And Thomas hasn't understood. So Jesus clarifies. And you might have expected it to go something like this. Okay, Thomas, my father's house. Well, let me describe it to you in these terms so that hopefully you'll get the picture. My father's house is a place of feasting. It's a place of music. It's a place of merriment. It's a big place. It's a beautiful place. It's a luxurious place. It's a place where angels serve and wait upon the residents. You might have expected him to go down that route, emphasizing the riches and the pleasures which abound there. But he doesn't. In fact, you may be thinking to yourselves, hang on, Dan, where is this clarification? I can't see it. Well, that's because it consists in an omission. In the second half of verse 6, Jesus says, no one comes to the Father's house except through me. No, he doesn't say that, does he? He says, no one comes to the Father except through me. He omits the word house. And in that, you have your clarification. That omission speaks volumes. It's Jesus saying, look, Thomas, the important thing that you need to know about my Father's house is that my Father lives there. It's my Father's presence that is the all-important thing. He, not some sensual pleasure, not some aesthetic delight, he is the dominating feature of that place. So much so, in fact, that if you like, Thomas, you can drop the word house altogether. If it's proving a red herring, if it's making you think primarily of a place, if it's evoking images mainly of a location, then dispense with the word. Because it isn't primarily a place which I left some 30 years ago to come here to planet Earth. It isn't primarily a place to which I'm soon going to return via my cross and resurrection and ascension. It isn't primarily a place to which I'm one day going to take you, disciples of mine. It's a person. It's the Father. Just as you, Thomas Didymus, during those heady days of courtship, no doubt took the future, Mrs. Didymus, not so much to see your family's residence as to meet your family members themselves. So I am one day going to take you disciples, not so much to see my Father's residence, as to meet my Father himself. And if then Thomas's need was to understand this, perhaps for the first time, perhaps your need and mine this morning is to be reminded of this, isn't it? That the central thing about heaven, the crucial thing about heaven, is that God lives there. It's the dwelling place of God. Do you sometimes think to yourself that it's very strange that the Bible tells us so little about heaven? That it barely even attempts to satisfy our curiosity about this subject? Well, actually, you know, there's a sense in which the Bible is all about heaven. Because the Bible is all about God, and God is heaven's main attraction. So that when the Bible tells us about God's faithfulness, and about God's holiness, and about God's mightiness, and about God's love, it is, in effect, telling us about heaven. Jeff Thomas tells the story of a deacon in his church there in Aberystwyth who some time ago worked for a while as a security guard at a local TV mast. Some nationalists were a bit upset about the amount of English-speaking television that was being produced and a small amount of well-speaking television, and so they were threatening to sabotage this local TV mast, hence the need for security guards to be posted there. And so this particular man, Gordon, he was on night duty most of the time, guarding this TV mast. And on most nights, the nationalists didn't show up, and so it was a fairly boring, mind-numbing job. And so his employers gave him a TV to watch. And in Jeff's own words then, right above That TV saw this massive transmitter. Mm. Gordon told me that he had never seen a TV picture like that one. You could see every pore in the newsreader's skin and every blade of grass on a football pitch because the set was so near to the transmitter. And you see, here in this world, you and I experience, don't we, the faithfulness and the holiness and the mightiness and the love of God. And we do so eagerly and we do so delightedly. But we do so remotely, if I may use that word. We do so at a distance. In heaven, however, these divine attributes are experienced close up, at their very source, unfiltered and undiluted, right next to the transmitter. As we sang a moment ago, those streams on earth I've tasted, more deep I'll drink above. This is what we were made for. I saw a documentary this past week about polar bears on Svalbard, that Arctic archipelago. Perhaps you saw the documentary too, and there were all these very sophisticated cameras then that were being used to track these different polar bear families as they desperately sought to survive amid some of the harshest conditions on planet Earth. And for one particular mother polar bear and her cub, it was a particularly desperate quest for survival, because at that point then, when spring was coming and the temperatures were beginning to rise and the ice at Svalbard was beginning to thaw, the polar bears customarily leave at that point and move northwards on these floating plates of ice. But for some reason, this particular mother bear and her cub didn't. They literally missed the boat, and they were marooned then on Svalbard for the whole summer, which meant there was no ice there for them, which meant there were no seals there for them, the seals attracted to the ice, and which meant then that it was very difficult for them to get any food. But as I say, these cameras followed these two bears there on Svalbard, and they had to resort to eating all sorts of things which polar bears wouldn't normally eat. They had to eat grass. They had to eat birds' eggs. At one point, you even saw these polar bears eating seaweed. It was rather a pathetic sight. These huge, magnificent creatures then are made to feed on meaty seals, and instead, they were feeding on pathetic little pieces of seaweed. And we human beings aren't made to feed on X Factor. We aren't made to feed on sales shopping. We aren't made to feed on the football results. We aren't made to feed on Hello magazine. We are made to feed on God himself. That's why unbelievers, whether or not they admit it even to themselves, deep down in the deepest recesses of their persons, they are frustrated because they were made to feed on God and they aren't feeding on God at all. They're feeding on seaweed. But even for those who are believers, who are feeding on God to some extent, there are still limits, aren't there? As Paul puts it so poignantly in 2 Corinthians 6 verse 5, as long as we're here in this world, we are to some extent absent from the Lord. But not in heaven, you see. There in heaven, there are no limits. What is heaven? Heaven is the unrestricted knowledge of and exposure to and engagement with the true and living God. This then is Jesus' clarification for Thomas. It comes in the form of an omission. What is the Father's house? The Father's house is where God is. Heaven is the presence of God himself. A clarification. Secondly, this morning, a claim. A claim. Who is right then between Jesus and Thomas? Because according to Jesus in verse 4, the disciples know the way to heaven. They know the way to the Father's house. According to Thomas, however, in verse 5, the disciples don't know the way to heaven. They don't know the way to the Father's house. Who is right between Jesus and Thomas? Well, I'm sure you guessed the answer already. Jesus is right. The disciples do know the way to heaven because they know Jesus. And Jesus himself, he now claims in verse 6, is the way to heaven. I, he says, I am the way. That's his claim. And so I just want to quickly draw out three things about this claim. First of all, it's a personal claim. It's a personal claim. So he doesn't say then, my way is the way to heaven. No, he says, I am the way to heaven. And that's a vitally, vitally important distinction. So there's a young child, and he's with his father on a walk out in the countryside. And at one point in the walk, they come to a quite difficult section. It's muddy, and it's steep, and there are these awkward tree roots getting in the way, and it's a bit problematic then for this young boy. And so in that situation, the father will probably do one of two things. Either he will say, look, son, walk right behind me. Follow my footsteps. Or he will pick up his son and carry his son across. He will probably do one of those two things. And for the child then, in the first of those two scenarios, he is simply going in his father's way. His father's way is the way for him to get across the difficult section. And so as he goes across, he has a trailblazer. He has someone in front of him. But still, it's difficult for the boy because still he has to negotiate the mud and the gradients and the awkward tree branches. His father is negotiating them in front of him and showing him the best route to take, but still, he's having to negotiate the same problems and the same barriers and the same obstacles that his father in front of him is negotiating. So in the first scenario then, his father's way is the way for him to get across. In the second scenario, however, his father himself is the way for him to get across. And all he has to do is rest in his father's arms and trust that his father is strong enough and capable enough and knows what he's doing sufficiently to get him safely across the difficult section. And you see, to get to heaven, it's the second scenario rather than the first. To get to heaven, it's not a case of going the way that Jesus went. To get to heaven, Jesus is the way. It's not that Jesus' way is our way, and thank God this morning that that's the case. Because Jesus' way, of course, was a unique way. Jesus' way to heaven was via hell. The hell which you and I deserve, there on that cross at Calvary. His route to heaven was via the anger and the judgment and the crushing of God himself. Jesus' way to heaven was a terrible way, an awful way, an unendurable way. Our way to heaven is simply resting by faith in Jesus' arms, trusting that he negotiated all the difficulties for us. Not that we have to negotiate the same difficulties after him, he having blazed the trail, but that he negotiated them in our place and on our behalf. And we simply trust, we simply rest. He's done it all. He will carry me through those pearly gates and into the glories and beauties of heaven. It's a personal claim. He's not pointing out a path, an objective, external path that we have to follow. He's saying, it's me. I am the way. Simply rest in my arms, trust in me like that boy trying to get across that difficult section. A personal claim. Secondly, it's an exclusive claim. It's an exclusive claim. I'm sure you've had that experience where you've been driving along the motorway and you can suddenly see that ahead of you traffic is building up. There's something of a jam, and just before then you have to join that traffic jam, there's a slipway going off the motorway. And so, not having a clue where that slipway goes, you just instinctively go off on that slipway to avoid the traffic jam ahead of you. And you then spend the next half hour or so desperately trying to rejoin the motorway further on, negotiating all these back routes and all these country lanes and all these little hamlets, trying to rejoin the motorway. And eventually you do, and you kind of feel half pleased with yourself that you've never had to stop moving, but also that you have that uneasy feeling that you might have got further along if you just joined the traffic jam after all. But you see, when it comes to getting to heaven, there isn't another way. There isn't a slip road. There aren't country lanes. There aren't back routes. There aren't little hamlets that you can go through. There's only one way to get to heaven, and that way is that trust in Jesus Christ that I've just described. No other religions provide an alternative way. No amount of moral goodness in our lives provide another way. You mustn't think that on that last day you will encounter an indulgent God, far too reluctant that anyone should miss out on heaven, who will in that moment provide another way. There is no other way. And I'm not, of course, resting the weight of these statements merely on the definite article, the word the. I am the way. But of course, Jesus doesn't just give us a definite article. He explicitly says so, doesn't he? No one comes to the Father. And we've said the Father there equals heaven. No one comes to heaven. No one makes it. No one gets there except through me. And of course, there are other Bible texts. Peter's great affirmation in Acts chapter 4 immediately springs to mind, upon which equally I'm resting the weight of these striking statements that now I'm making. There is no other way. Let me put it to you as plainly as I possibly can. If you're not trusting in Jesus Christ, you will not go to heaven. It's as simple and as stark as that. You can put a full stop at the end of that sentence. It's as irreducible as that. If you're not trusting in Jesus Christ, you will not go to heaven. It's an exclusive claim. I alone am the way. A personal claim, an exclusive claim. And then thirdly, a reasoned claim. A reasoned claim. Because you'll notice then that Jesus adds two other terms, doesn't he? He says, I am the way and the truth and the life. And I think we need to understand that the whole context here then is the route that one must take to get to the Father's house. That's what has prompted this comment in the first place. That's the note on which Jesus ends in verse 6. And so I don't think we should take these claims to be the truth and the life as kind of separate, unrelated claims. That Jesus is kind of claiming here to be three quite distinct and unrelated things, the way, the truth, and the life. He's talking here in this whole context about being the way. And when he adds, therefore, that he's also the truth and the life, he's saying that, he's claiming that, because that in some way explains how he's the way. He is the way because he's the truth and he's the life. First of all, then, he's the truth. What does he mean by that? Well, I think that the best way of discerning the meaning there is to go back to chapter 1. Remember, we read that passage earlier on in our service. And there, Jesus' identity is brought out in very significant ways, isn't it? First of all, in that great title, the Word. That's how John begins, isn't it, by describing Jesus as the Word. What does he mean by that? Well, he means that Jesus is the expression of what God is like. A word expresses something, doesn't it? A word reveals something. Jesus is the expression, the revelation of what God is like. And then, of course, that's expanded later on at the end of that passage, verse 18. Where John says that Jesus is the one who makes God known. Or literally, he he exegetes God. He narrates God. He describes God. Jesus is the authoritative, final description of who God is. And so to come back then to this verse, when Jesus claims here to be the truth, that's what he means. He doesn't simply mean that everything he says is true, although that's correct. But he's saying more than that. He's saying, I am the truth, the definitive truth about God. I am the word. I am the expression. I am the narration. I am the description of God. And so, why then is it that Jesus is the only way? Why can't we go via other religions? Why can't we go via a religion over here that says as long as you live a good enough life, you'll make it? Or why can't we go via the route of a religion over here which says as long as you go through these rites and these ceremonies and these rituals and you wash 7 times a day in the right kind of water, then you'll make it to heaven? Why are those routes to heaven no good? Why does it have to be faith in the crucified and risen Jesus Christ? Well, the answer is because God is how Jesus has revealed him. God is this holy God whose standards cannot possibly be met by our moral rectitude or by our washing in some fancy kind of water. God is a holy God, but a gracious God who can be known and can be related to through the sacrifice that he himself has provided. Jesus has made all that known about God. Jesus has shown us that's what God is like, and only therefore the religion of Jesus Christ and trusting in him meets those criteria. Only the religion of clinging helplessly to Jesus Christ fits that bill and can possibly be the way to heaven. A religion of moral rectitude, that doesn't fit with a holy God. A religion of washing and going through all kinds of rites, that doesn't fit with a holy God. Only a religion that is helplessly clinging to a Saviour who gave himself freely for us, only that fits the bill. But then he claims not only to be the truth, but also the life. And you see, this is reminding us then that between us and heaven lies one very formidable barrier, doesn't there? Death. Between us and heaven lies death. And therefore, only a religion that can cope with that barrier, only a religion that can cope with the finality and the weightiness and the solemnity of death can possibly be a valid route to heaven. And why then not any of the other religions? Because they don't have an answer to death. They don't have an answer to the finality and the weightiness and the solemnity of death. Only the religion of Jesus Christ, the one who has already proven that he is the life by raising Lazarus a couple of chapters earlier, and the one who will prove it even more demonstrably and even more graphically by rising himself from the dead at the end of this gospel. Only he, only the one who is the life, can possibly cope with the awful horrors, the awful reality, the cold hand of death. And I'm saying that it's because Jesus is the truth, and because he is the life, that he alone is the way. There's no other religion which fits the facts about God, which he, as God's authoritative representative, has made known. There's no other religion which can cope with the terrible reality of death. But he is the truth, and he is the life, and therefore he is the way. And so it simply leads me to ask you the question this morning. Are you on that way? Are you clinging to Jesus Christ by faith? Are you like that little boy negotiating that difficult section of the walk by resting in his Father's arms? Are you resting in Jesus Christ? Not simply seeking to set his ideals before your eyes as a fine example. That will get you nowhere. But clinging to him who through his death and resurrection has provided everything you need. Cling to Jesus this morning. If you've never done so yet, he is the way to the Father's house. Amen.